Welcome to the Pathways Podcast. My name is Mary Spiro. I'm your host. And today we'll be talking with Dr. Valerie Weaver. She's a cross-disciplinary researcher. She's the director of the Center for Bioengineering and Tissue Regeneration in the Department of Surgery at the University of California, San Francisco. She also has cross appointments in bioengineering and therapeutic sciences and in the radiation oncology department. And she has trained as a biochemist. In fact, you could possibly say she's the poster child for interdisciplinary research. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Weaver.
Thank you so much for this wonderful opportunity to share, the interest and my passion.
So specifically today, we're going to talk a little bit about the Molecular Biology of the Cell journal, their special edition, Forces on and Within Cells. This is coming up on the sixth edition of that. So why is it really important for cell biologists to consider physical forces? Because I know you have a training in biochemistry, and I know a lot of cell biologists are working in that realm, but why do we need to think about the physical cells? What can we learn from that?
So having been trained as a biochemist and fallen in love with cell biology, sensitized to the chemistry of life and looking at biochemical modifications. But once you start studying the fact that there are also physical modifications elicited by force, then you start realizing that it's the other side of the coin and that we live in a physical world, and that every single molecule within your cell and every tissue is subjected to some level of force. And not to appreciate that this plays an intimate role in the cell biology and tissue physiology and development is at our own peril. So to me, I'm very dedicated to this exciting and wonderful area of investigation.
What are you hoping to see in this new sixth edition?
Well, at its inception, there was a kind of novelty, by cell biologists studying, mechanical forces on cells. And the study was pretty basic. But as the field has matured, so too has our understanding of the nuances of how force regulates everything from chromatin and transcription and transport and various different cell biological processes and tissue physiology and development. And so does each of these series or each of these issues is that we watch with growing appreciation as the field really matures and scientists' understanding matures alongside of it. The field is now, I would say, pretty established, but it's still taking a while to percolate through other areas. So I look forward to the new cutting edge technologies, new insights, how this can be married to our understanding of other aspects of cell biology. I love the new work that's coming out. I think it's fabulous.
Tell me about some of the editors that will be joining you this time. Is this the typical group of editors, or do you have like a kind of a rotating roster? How does that work?
When I was first asked to lead this, my first thought was my career has been characterized by collaborations and an embracement of interdisciplinary sciences. And I recognize that as a biochemist who embraced cell biology, that I really needed to bring on board individuals with expertise in complementary areas. So for example, Alpha Yap has been doing cell biology for decades. He's a fabulous scientist. He's a lovely colleague, and he's led initiatives, and he's also from a different part of the world. So I wanted to bring somebody like Alpha Yap on board. I embraced Alex Dunn. He thinks about things he's a biophysicist, and he thinks about things in very, very careful detail. And he loves things that are like at the biophysical level and molecular level. And he brings to the initiative that perspective. And he's also a wonderful colleague, very collegial. You know, over the years, I have brought in additional editors. Initially, I thought I was going to rotate people, but, you know, it's kind of settled on a core. And then we bring in some new faces to really kind of reflect the field. Dennis Disher, I knew Dennis from, you know, from when I was at Penn. This is like 15 years ago. I started in 1999. He brings in another aspect because he's a classic, you know, mechanical engineer, and has studied mechanobiology for decades. And he brings in his perspective. So each of the editors that we call on to collaborate and bring their work really do bring in new ideas and perspectives. And they're all super dedicated to this endeavor. I certainly don't rule out the possibility that certain individuals will become tired and want to rotate off because it's a certain commitment of time and energy. But I do know that those that are participating are very genuinely wedded to this idea. And we do think the best home for this is molecular biology of the cell. You know, this is the cell biology, American Society for Cell Biology journal. This is where the home needs to be for this kind of initiative. And I'm proud that we've brought home a lot of people that are now looking every year to publish their work here.
What are some of the recent discoveries or findings that you have seen in the realm of forces, physical sciences, and cell biology? What are you excited about?
As the field matures, so too does the technology. Initially, it was doubtful that you could measure traction force or forces cells exerted in a 3D context. But that work has moved forward with ever increasing sophistication. So that's really exciting. Some of the force sensors have, you know, initially their, you know, signal to noise ratio was not particularly impressive, but that too has, as the technology has become more mature and more sophisticated, that too has increased. What I, of course, am excited about as well is there's also some really cool work going on with looking at cell forces transmitted in and to the nucleus. And that area has become more nuanced as to what's really going on. That I think is a hot area that's developing novel smart materials, understanding how to interface between all the omics group work, looking forward to in situ methods to measure and quantify and analyze force in not only in cells, but in tissues. What else can I think about? I personally have a goal of bringing a lot of this work in vivo for development and for disease, because I think that's where we will have a very good outreach to colleagues in other fields, because I do genuinely believe that if a researcher, an investigator thinks something is important to their field to help them to understand it, they will be first in line to try to understand it and study it. We as a group have an obligation to make our field more accessible and easier for people to work with.
Tell me a little bit about the length scales of these forces. And then also tell me a little bit about how the forces play into something like metastasis, cancer, that sort of thing.
You know, it's not one size fits all. I know I do have some colleagues in the engineering realm that believe, you know, that cells respond the same to all forces across length scales. At the molecular level, what you could speak about, for example, I mean, I study adhesions and what have you. So there is a specific force that is implicated in helping to unfold, for example, TALEN or, you know, vinculin, and that's at the molecular level. And so it actually has a nice parallel with, my chemical modifications that change the charge on the molecule that actually then favor unfolding, for example. So when you're thinking on that length scale, you're thinking on a molecular length scale, you're really thinking about, like, that's my area of biochemistry. It makes sense to me. This is where you can imagine a cell and a molecule would actually interface and be regulated by mechanical cues, right? It's force. When you start moving up length scales and you start thinking about how sort of contractility in a cell, which is, you know, kind of, you know, forces being pulled in, that can influence things like membrane topology. It can influence membrane curvature, which then gets reinforced by proteins that bind to the membrane. So as you move up length scales, you also increase complexity. So the easiest to understand, of course, at the molecular level, right? Because you can say without too much, you know, difficulty that this level of force does X to unfold or increase the unfolding configuration of a protein, you know, that's easier to understand. When you start going into a large, longer length scale, then it becomes more difficult. So for example, calcium regulated ion channels or piezo channels, you know, you're hearing, you have, you know, hair deflection, which leads to and regulates the activation of calcium channels. That elicits a signal, but then it becomes really complicated because then you have signal transduction and you have multiple other effects because you can influence cell contractility, which can have pleiotropic effects in the cell. And then when you move up a further length scale and you get into sort of tissue ensembles or cell ensembles, you know, cells can transmit forces across tissues and across cells. Now that's where it becomes interesting because when you think about it, evolutionarily speaking, you know, it's a much more efficient, it's crude, it's coarse grained. As you go up length scale, it's more coarse grained, right? So when you think about it, you know, way back in evolution, you know, multicellular organisms, you know, had to learn how to beat, you know, their flagella or whatever in coordinated fashion. That's a mechanical, you know, cue that allowed for multicellular organisms to start to develop and evolve, right? But it's coarse grained. So if I'm in a tissue and I pull on one side of the tissue through the extracellular matrix, I can evoke an effect, very large length scale, number of, you know, centimeters and millimeters away, right? Much more so than the percolation and, you know, of some kind of chemical cue, but it's going to be much coarser, much cruder. So that's where I think about it. And then when you move up to a further length scale, then it becomes, you know, even more difficult to define and to rigorously say, this is caused by this, which is why you have skeptics, because skeptics will say, we need to see specifically that force does X. Okay, so implicating it in something as complex as something like cancer and metastases, that's the challenge, right? That's the big challenge about how do you really, decipher this? How do you start to attribute, you know, causality? Becomes very difficult, but it's certainly worth doing. I've dedicated, we do development work. We've had some development articles on early gastrulation. We just had one last year in DevCell, but most of my work has been dedicated to understanding tumor pathogenesis, cancer risk, cancer development, cancer metastases, things like that. And the challenge is pretty impressive. It's pretty hard, but I'm not going to balk at it. And I do think having model systems that you can go in vivo for that becomes incredibly important because then they become accessible. You can't study something and expect the rest of the community to buy into it unless you make it easy enough for them to study and for them to manipulate. If you make it some kind of elite little group and you use fancy language, they're gonna look at you and go, oh, you're really clever, blah, blah, blah. That's really cute. Pat, pat, pat. There's Weaver in her little, you know, soapbox blabbing on about, you know, forces in cancer. And I believe me, I'm invited to a lot of these programs. And it's kind of like, yeah, there's Weaver and the other. I will have failed if I don't make my work accessible and encourage others to look at it because I know I sound like a zealot, but I really truly believe it's important.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely interesting that you brought up the fact that people maybe don't believe you or you have to sort of state your case and make your case. I mean, I guess I would think that the data or evidence that you present would be enough, but it's interesting that you say that. So that sounds like a big challenge. I also am wondering about the challenge of the technical aspect of it, in the sense that there's heterogeneity across cells within a same population.
Absolutely.
You've got a lot of like variables, and then you talked about trying to do this in vivo and in 3D. Like, that's crazy.
So I'll give you an example. And I think it's actually interesting. So developmental biologists, they buy into what we're doing. Absolutely. Because they think about complex systems and they think about emergent properties of multicellular organisms, and they think along these lines. So I have no issues and no problems relating to these people. And there's where, there are like a lot of these really basic models you can work with, early gastrulation models, and you can do manipulations. Where the trouble becomes, as you rightly pointed out, is when you start bringing it into higher organisms like mice, and of course, trying to study for people. So then the challenge is, how do you address something like you said, heterogeneity across the tissue, cause and effect? How do you bring that so that it's technically accessible? So I'll give you one example. Many of us have gone in, and I started off when I moved to UCSF to develop methods to measure tension or stiffness in a tissue slice. So we developed methods to do that, but that's not accessible to everybody, right? We started doing it in clinical specimens to demonstrate, relate this to disease, genotype and phenotype and how things work. That's still not accessible, okay? And it doesn't take into account the fact that it's really painful to do it. So then I have a very talented young student who's developed a scanning AFM method, which builds on and moves well beyond what had been published about 10 years ago. And this way you can actually visually register where you are. Again, people don't have AFM, so they're not gonna do this. So what he's done is he's used AI, and he's developed a method by which you can, through machine learning, you can actually have the system identify morphological features in the matrix that actually correlate very, very significantly with mechanical, with stiffness measurements. So that means that you can take a human tissue section, and you can say, there's a little region within that tissue that has very high force. And guess what? We can determine that by looking at morphological features of the matrix, which is really cool. So then we also work with another group that took radiological imaging modalities, where they have, they've identified 900 different morphological features of the collagen. And they've actually then been able to use this to identify certain features in the extracellular matrix that predict which ductal carcinomas progress. Now, it literally goes down to the point where you would take it, image it, and then out would come a number. That makes it accessible to everybody. The imaging modality that links it back to, the mechanical features makes it accessible to everybody. So you would have a code. And then the actual heterogeneity becomes interesting, because you would say within a tumor, there's a region that actually has a high tension. That region, look, it has differences in gene expression that might predict which of these patients are going to end up with a metastatic disease. So one needs to think creatively about how to pull these together. And all the spatial registration, all the spatial analysis, that's where it's going in development. That's where it's going in cancer. That's where it's going in, it's always been there in cardiovascular. So that's where the field's moving with respect to understanding, these, how this works.
What are some other technologies that you think will be helpful to cell biologists in the future?
Besides AI and machine learning?
Mm-hmm.
We need imaging approaches. Some of the genomics and I'm embracing very strongly the glycobiology kind of aspect, because that has been, for many cell biologists, a terrifying area to delve into, because it's complicated. I wouldn't have done it without my colleague, Carolyn Bertazzi, who's absolutely fabulous. And I had a postdoc who now is his own lab, Matt Pezek, who, you know, really moved me towards that area. So where that you can actually becomes more accessible with the omics approaches, but also in situ omics. So the, you know, gene expression at the single cell level, we're working with colleagues to do that, because then you can overlay and understand even in a developing tissue during gastrulation, we know that we can configure the geometry of the tissue and change where the gastrulation starts. But that, what does that do to the chromatin? What does it do to the metabolism? So metabolomics, in situ metabolomics becomes important. So that's definitely an area, the whole omics, because everybody in the other fields, they're all omics mad, you know? So if the mechanobiology group ignores it, they do it at their own peril. I think that we need to get with the program.
We want to avoid the bad omics though.
Well, I mean, the point is to not just, you know, throw everything on the wall and see what sticks. I mean, some of my trainees in the past have done all this stuff. And I said, don't come to me with the top gene after we spent $50,000 on all this work. I want to think about this you want to synthesize the data. We need to be smarter. We need to think more quantitative. But, you know, I said the biggest and most critical and expensive piece of equipment we have is our own brain. Use it. You can quote me on that.
You have quoted yourself. What are some of the things that you hope will be in the future for the intersection between cell biology and the physical sciences?
Well, I think that mechanobiology is becoming a mainstay in cell development, in developmental biology. And I do think in cell biology. And so, you know, the companies and the technology that is becoming available makes it more accessible to study. What I will reiterate, I really do think that we need to develop organisms with four sensors, whether that's C. elegans. I mean, we had a paper last year where we worked with people, the Dillon group, to do C. elegans manipulations because it's more, you know, accessible. You know, so that you can actually manipulate and sense and quantify forces in real time to understand what is going on. And the technology is moving. It's moving in that direction. And like I said earlier, I know, come on, I'm a researcher. If something is cool and accessible, your people in your lab are gonna grab onto it and they're gonna use it because they can do it. You know, part of it is that you can't, that's why they do it. Now, we don't want everybody to just say, oh, here's forces here and there and the other place. You want to actually be rational about what it means and try to understand it. So we need the framework to understand. We need the theory to catch up. Initially, there was a kind of free-for-all excitement. Oh, we can measure it, so let's measure it. We can manipulate certain things, so let's do so. And a lot of culture work. You know, we need to move forward, just like we need to think about things in three dimensions. You know, there was a whole beautiful Meccano initiative at Singapore that Mike Sheets was leading. And I kept, you know, I was like a dog with a bone. I kept saying, Mike, you need to bring your group to study force in 3D. You need to look at dimensionality and how it affects things. But, you know, it's difficult. And so people study what is easier than what is more challenging. And so it's up to researchers such as myself who will push forward to try to demonstrate to people why it's important and how to do it. So we have a paper coming out hopefully soon in EMBO that describes what is how tension and force is different in 2D and 3D. And why do we care? You know, what's it really doing? That's important.
Yeah, I remember when I first was exposed to that. I'm not a scientist, but when I was first exposed to the idea of, oh yeah, we've been studying cells on flat petri dishes for long enough, we need to look at them in 3D. And I was like, well, of course. But now I felt like everything that I'd learned in cell biology was wrong.
Oh, I would never say that. Never. All models are, what is the saying? All models are bad, but some are useful. You know, all models are not perfect, but some are useful. Mm-hmm. You know, we study models. The 3D, come on, 3D organoids in Matrigel, tumors don't develop in Matrigel. They don't develop. That's if, unless they're a sarcoma. So it's completely insane to say that's superior. Mm-hmm. It's just different. And so one needs to be aware. And when you get down to a molecular level and you're looking at how force regulates the unfolding of a protein, you don't need to do it in 3D because it's irrelevant. It's like ridiculous. So you need to be thoughtful and how to interpret your data and what model is useful for what thing and get off our high horse. You know, I was programmed when I came out of the Bissell lab that, oh, everything had to be like 3D, you know, and it took me a long time to start becoming a little more cognizant of how to appropriately study things. And I know that 10 years from now, I'll look back and be embarrassed at what I did, because again, you know, you keep learning. If you don't, then you're brain dead. I'm the first one. I don't know how to do AI. I'm like, if I had to do it again, I would learn, but I'm a dinosaur. So I put my faith. If you ask me, where do I think the field is going? It's with our young people. They understand that you need to do interdisciplinary work. They need to, and you know, with this whole COVID thing, I am so concerned that our young people are going to be very distraught and dissuaded from pursuing this wonderful field. And we need them. We need this for the future. They're going to be the ones that are going to protect us from global warming, for goodness sake. You know?
Well, that's a lot to take. That's a lot to unpack right there. But I appreciate everything that you've shared with me today about your editing of the forces on and within cells. The deadline for that is March 1st, correct?
Yeah.
And you want not abstracts, but full submissions?
I think what I would suggest is, yeah, we need full submissions. But if someone has a proposed manuscript that they think would be suitable, I have no problem if they wanted to contact myself or one of my other fellow editors. And I would talk to Matt about whether or not we hold a Zoom meeting at some point to field questions, because there's always a lot of individuals that want to know what it is that they need. You know, it's a cell biology journal. It's a good journal. So, you know, a wholly descriptive it's not a place to park something that's not good quality. You need to actually have, you know, good science that you put in. It's a good journal. It's a fabulous journal. And I stand behind it 150%.
That's fantastic. And I also want to point out the fact that my understanding with MBOC is that the editors really give very constructive feedback, that I've heard authors say that they are just really pleased with the feedback and that it improves their science dramatically.
Yeah, well, we want good work to be published. I mean, we're all, that's everything too. We are scientists ourselves. You know, we're not professional editors. We're scientists. We're doing our own work. So we just happen to be, you know, on this group, this board, to help, you know, basically see these papers have the light of day. So we want good science to be read, and we would like it to be published in this journal.
Is there anything else that you want to tell me today about this particular special issue?
To the young people, if you have any questions, cell biology is a fabulous place. We now have the most amazing tools and, you know, super interesting questions, particularly in the mechanobiology field. And I really strongly encourage you to read our issues. And if you have work, to encourage your PIs to allow you to submit to our journal. And more than happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Well, thanks so much, Dr. Weaver, for taking time to chat with me today.
You have a wonderful rest of the year. Let's hope 2022 sees the end of COVID. And exactly. Everybody stays healthy and happy.
Great. Terrific. Thanks a lot.